Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A couple times now, you know, because people will ask, what do you want readers to close the book and feel? I want them to feel like they're as loved as Ferris is loved. I want them to feel like they are in that house and that they can go up to Charisse's room and sit and play cards with her. I want them to feel like what it's like to have Boomer, a dog who's part woolly mammoth and part sheepdog, sleeping on your feet at night, anchoring you to the earth. I want a kid to feel that kind of love, the way that Ferris feels love. That's what I want somebody to walk away from this book with.
Hey everyone, I'm Bianca Schultz from the Children's Book Review, and this is the Growing Readers Podcast. Today's guest is a three-time visitor, and I want you to get ready to catch some stardust that follows this star of a children's book writer wherever she goes. It's none other than the wonderful Kate DiCamillo. As you likely know, Kate is one of America's most beloved storytellers. She is a former national ambassador for young people's literature and a two-time Newbery medalist. Born in Philadelphia, she grew up in Florida and now lives in Minneapolis. Now, before I share our conversation, here's the synopsis for her latest novel, Ferris. The beloved author of Because of Winn-Dixie has outdone herself with a hilarious and achingly real love story about a girl, a ghost, a grandmother, and growing up. It's the summer before fifth grade, and for Ferris Wilkie, it is a summer of sheer pandemonium. Her little sister, Pinky, has vowed to become an outlaw. Uncle Ted has left Aunt Shirley, and Ferris's mother's chagrin is holed up in the Wilkie basement to paint a history of the world. And Charisse, Ferris's grandmother, has started seeing a ghost at the threshold of her room, which seems like an alarming omen given that she is also feeling unwell. But the ghost is not there to usher Charisse to the great beyond. Rather, she has other plans. Wild, impractical, illuminating plans. How can Ferris satisfy a specter with Pinky terrorizing the town, Uncle Ted sending Ferris to spy on her aunt, and her father battling an invasion of raccoons? As Charisse likes to say, every good story is a love story, and Kate DiCamillo has written one for the ages. Emotionally resonant and healing, showing the two-time Newbery medalist at her most playful, universal, and profound. Well, hello, Kate DiCamillo. Welcome back to the Growing Readers Podcast for the third time. I am so honored that you are here.
Well, you know how happy I am to be here. I've been looking forward to us talking, so it's a real treat for me.
Yeah, well, I'm just super curious. Between the last time we chatted, which was kind of before all the holiday ho-hum, and now we're talking in February, and this episode will air in March when your new book, Ferris, comes out. So have you been up to anything exciting in the last couple of months?
You know what's exciting for me is coming down the stairs in the morning and pouring the coffee and going in there and writing. That's where all the excitement is. And so I've been working really hard with writing and feeling lucky to get to do it, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's Ramona shaking her collar there. So yeah, we'll just ignore her.
Hi, Ramona. I also have to ask. So I loved our little slipper moment from the last conversation.
I know. Every time I look at my slippers in the bathroom, I think of you.
Yeah. Same here. I think of you too. And I was just curious if anybody's gifted you any more slippers, and do you have any extra slippers in your collection now?
No, I'm holding steady at two. But you know, I'm old enough now that each time my feet slip into either pair, I go, oh man, that feels so good. Yeah.
Yeah. I was planning to put my matching Kate DiCamillo slippers on my feet, and I'm actually sitting here embarrassed to say I'm barefoot and my feet are cold. So,
well, you know, it's funny that it's taken me a long time to become a slipper person, but now sign me up, and the comfort of it is so great. And then to have people that you love give you slippers, and then, you know, to have you have the same slippers that that was a moment for the books right there.
It was pretty funny. Well, you're here today to talk about Ferris, which is your latest, greatest book. And I noticed that you dedicated the latest story to your bestie with amazing taste in slippers, which is Tracy Bailey, yeah, and also to Rainey Stewart. So I love reading dedications, and I always wonder, you know, how someone, like how you chose to dedicate a specific book to someone. So was there a meaning to that particular dedication?
Yeah, I'm like you. I love dedications. And I also love acknowledgments. Those are like, you know, I'll start in a book and then I'll go back and look and see who it's for. And then I'll go to the end and see if there are acknowledgments. All of that helps me piece together whose heart I'm holding in my hands, you know? And so this book is for Tracy Bailey, as you said, who's the friend of my youth. And Rainey is her granddaughter. And this book of Ferris is a book of, it's a love story. And one of the many love stories in it is between a granddaughter and her grandmother. And so Tracy and Rainey were very much on my mind as I was writing. And it was actually Rainey's birth that kind of fully formed this idea of telling Ferris's story. Rainey was born on the last day of 2019. And, really early in the morning, and all these pictures kept coming in of this beautiful baby surrounded by her mother and her father and two sets of grandparents. And I just thought, what's it like to come into the world and from the minute you arrive, you know that you're loved? And so that's kind of where I started.
It was funny because you had mentioned Tracy Bailey in our last episode, or, you know, with the slippers and whatnot. And so when I read the name Rainey Stewart, I didn't know that connection. And so I love that was the first question I asked you, because it kind of led into the next question that I want to get to. You know, when we talked a while back on the podcast about the Beatrice prophecy, you revealed in a sense that you're kind of more of a hamster versus a plotter when it comes to creating your stories. So for Ferris, I wanted to know what the beginning moment of the story coming to you was. And, you know, you sort of just touched on that. But how did this story continue to reveal itself to you as you were writing? As, you know, you kind of said you let the story come to you just as a reader lets the story come to them. So,
yeah, you know, It was an unusual place for me to start a book with something conceptual rather than a character name or an image. Although I do suppose I had an image, which was that child surrounded from with law from the minute that she arrived. And so I had no idea where I was going. And it's not only that it's a different for me to start with a concept, it's also different. And there's really no simple way to say this. It's or easy way to say it. I've never started from a place of wholeness before. All of the other novels deal with a missing parent or a fractured family. And here I was starting whole, which in a strange way is kind of like really setting a huge hurdle as far as storytelling goes, because you don't have a conflict, but you do have a conflict, I found, which is being human, because it's like to be here means that we have to love with the whole of ourselves, knowing that what we love is eventually going to leave one way or another. And so I immersed myself in that love between Ferris and her grandmother, Charisse. And then one by one, all the other characters came and revealed themselves, last but not least, Pinky, Ferris's sister, who is one of those characters who, from the minute she shows up, threatens to derail the whole story because she's so strong and so dynamic. And so as soon as I had all the characters, then it was just this thing of following my way, really, to I could feel that there was a lighted place that I was going to. And that's ultimately where I ended up. I don't want to give anything away.
I feel like everything you just touched on is almost attached to every single question I have written down here for you today. So this is such a great lead-in of a response. I was as you were, you know, talking, I was listening and taking in what you were saying, but I was also looking at my questions and thinking, gosh, you know, I thought I had these ordered so well, but you know, now maybe I need to ask this question next. You know, I'm gonna stay in my order because I think you just led us in perfectly to all right. The questions. Yeah, all the questions. I think you need to talk to me specifically right now about Ferris. She is the lead character. And, you know, your stories are all so beautifully driven by these eccentric personalities. But Ferris she's found herself navigating a pretty chaotic summer filled with a little bit of family turmoil and some personal challenges are going on. But since your books do always contain such eccentric personalities, why and how did Ferris rise to the top to be your lead character? Because, you know, maybe this seed of the idea came from, you know, coming into the world and being surrounded by love. But, you know, Ferris is a fifth grader, right? And she's really becoming herself. So out of all the characters, you know, why was it Ferris that rose to the top?
She's kind of the still center of this great storm, a loving storm. So it's just like it was that certainty that she has of being loved that was gifted to her from the minute that she arrived. And then she just kind of literally stands in the middle of all of these people. And as you said, they're quite eccentric, and she is the least eccentric of the lot. But she is the still center of everybody, of all these eccentric people that, you know, circle around her. She is the, and as I make the circle, I think of the Ferris wheel, and which that's, you know, how Ferris, her actual name is Emma Phineas Wilkie, but she's called Ferris because she was born at the fairgrounds beneath the Ferris wheel in a great unexpected rush. She arrived in the world, and her grandmother was there and was the person who caught her when she arrived. And that's why they call her Ferris. But she is the still center of that wheel and the lodestar, if you will.
I love that metaphor and analogy of the Ferris wheel. And again, no spoilers here, but from someone who's read it from start to finish, I mean, that is a perfect analogy for who she is, and particularly who she is in this story. So this story delves into a variety of social emotional themes, in especially family dynamics. But I feel as though if I was to sum up this story in just one sentence, if I could be so bold.
Yeah, I can't wait. Maybe I'll be able to use it.
I would say to feel the pain of grief is to know the beauty and joy of love. So to feel the pain of grief is to know the beauty and joy of love. I want to ask you, is that an okay assessment?
That is a beautiful assessment. And it goes back to exactly the thing that I said when I was rambling in the beginning about how, oh, wait, you're going to have a child with a totally intact and loving family. Where is the story? Story is in being human. And to be human is to grieve, to mourn, to lose, and to love with our whole selves.
There's a sentiment repeated throughout that originates with Ferris's grandmother, Charisse. And she said, every good story is a love story. And so that sort of becomes a musical refrain. I mean, not literally music, but it's repeated often throughout. And so I want you to talk to me about what this means to you. And do you believe that every good story is a love story?
Yeah, I should be prepared to get this question a lot more about whether or not I believe it. Let's start there with the easier part of that question. I do believe it. I believe it as a reader, and I believe it as a writer, because that is what every good story has done for me. It's showed me how to love the world, how to love the people around me, and how to love and understand myself. I feel like that's what stories can do. So while it might not be a love story on the surface, it is still a love story if it teaches me how to love. And that's what stories, writing them and reading them, has done for me. Where did the refrain come from? And I do like it that it's like almost like a leitmotif, right? You know, it is almost musical, and I'm glad that you said it that way. That's one of those things where Charisse said it, and I thought, what a beautiful sentence. And I don't know where it came from other than to say that that's, it's, you know, I've said this before, the stories are smarter than I am. The characters are smarter than I am. Charisse utters this, and I think, yes, that is so.
Well, and I think that maybe you are smarter than you think you are yourself,
no,
Kate.
I'm not. I'm only smart enough to get out of my own way. That's the limits of my smartness, is to know, you know, to when to put my ego aside and be guided by this greater thing, you know?
Yeah. Love manifests itself in various forms throughout the story. There's intergenerational love. There's parent child relationships, there's siblings as best friends. So I'd love to read an excerpt to you that highlights one of my favorite ways in which you show a form of love. I hope that's okay. And it starts on page one, chapter one. And when I read this particular bit, I knew from that moment that I was going to be really happy where you took me as a reader. So I'm going to grab the book.
I'm really looking forward to you reading to me, and it will be a chance for me to hear it in a different way. So, yeah.
It was the summer that Ferris's best friend, Billy Jackson, played a song called Mysterious Barricades over and over again on the piano. Billy Jackson loved music. The very first sentence he had ever spoken to Ferris was, "I hear piano music in my head all the time, and I wonder, would it be all right if I held on to your hand?" They were standing in Mrs. Bleeker's kindergarten classroom. Squares of sunlight were shining on the wood floors, and Ferris gave her hand to Billy Jackson while he continued to explain to her about the piano music in his head. Billy's hand was sweating. His glasses were attached to his head with a strap, and Ferris knew almost immediately from that very first moment that she didn't want to ever lose hold of Billy Jackson. She said, "There's a piano at our house. You can come over and play it whenever you want." I love that demonstration of how love shows up. You know, I mean, I think it's so easy to think of love as romance and people getting married as a child. But I think it's important to remember that, that love actually shows up in these tiny moments of somebody being vulnerable and somebody else being there for them. Yeah. And I love that Ferris took Billy Jackson's hand. So
yeah, and that she knows. It's also that thing about being open to, I always say I recognize my people when I see them. I know who my people are. And Ferris, because she's been so well loved, knows also who she loves. And she knows from the first minute that she loves him and she wants to hold on to him. Yeah.
I'm not sure if you remember reading me a portion of Ursula K. Le Guin's essay, Operating Instructions, which was from
her book. Wasn't that exciting? That was so exciting when we did that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was from the Words Are My Matter, and in which she says, reading is a means of listening. Mm-hmm. And when you read that to me, that just so resonated. So with that in mind, reading is a means of listening. I wonder what you hope readers will hear from reading about the various relationships that you've portrayed in Ferris. What do you think they're going to hear and take away? So I noticed that spot of love when she reached out in the hands, but what do you think the children readers will hear about love?
I don't know. I hope that on like a subconscious level, and I like also that we're saying hearing, because it goes to, this is a book that is implicitly about music, you know, when you think about it, because we is back to that refrain, that leitmotif of every good story is a love story. And then Billy Jackson playing again and again the same song. So it's like music is woven into everything here. And so it's like, hopefully the book will be like a song that a kid, that it does two things. It shows, without being explicit, but you know, on a subconscious musical level, that there is love everywhere, and there are all kinds of ways to love in the world. So there's familial love. There's, like you said, intergenerational love. There's Charisse and Mr. Bowie. There's just there's Ferris and Billy Jackson. There's Billy Jackson and his mom who's gone. You know, there's just all these ways to love, all these ways to be in the world and to love. And I hope that you might not think about all of that consciously, but I hope that as a reader you feel it.
Okay, so here's where I think we need to go right now. So something that we talked about in our conversation for the Puppets of Spellhorse was the need to find light even in times of darkness, especially in times of darkness. And I feel as though while there's undertones of sadness in this story, it's really just such a beautiful, joy-filling book. So for me, light comes in so many different forms. And, you know, one of those forms is people who show up for each other, which your characters do in this book in so many unique ways. And there's a chandelier that could bring metaphoric and literal light to this story. But there's also the light that you provide that may not be as obvious to readers, but it's what we're talking about right now. And that is the form of music. So you reference the piece of music that Billy Jackson plays on the piano over and over again, which is Mysterious Barricades. So I had to go and listen to it on iTunes because I didn't know it. I didn't know the piece. And I think I know why you picked that particular piece. That's so rude of me to say, I know why you picked it.
Well, I can't wait to hear, because it's still, well, I'll tell you, I'll let you say, and then I'll tell you my bit. So go ahead.
So I feel as though you picked it because it's the right amount of light and joy and a hint of sadness. So that's why I felt like you picked it. And I felt like it really did embody what your story does to me as a reader.
Oh, That's a beautiful thing. And, you know, I always have music when I'm writing a particular thing that will take me as I write through a book. And I had Mysterious Barricades playing over and over again. And, you know, it was a piece that I knew Francois Couperin wrote it for harpsichord. And so I knew it on harpsichord, but it didn't make me stop in my tracks until I heard it on the piano, Angela Hewitt playing it on the piano. And it just did that thing where it just, you know, you feel like something inside of you open up. And it does that to Billy Jackson, and he doesn't know why. And it'll, you know, it's that thing of music being able to articulate the ineffable. And, you know, the title, Mysterious Barricades, no one has any idea why it's titled that. No one knows what barricades there are that Couperin is referencing. But I like to think that it's the barriers that we all have inside of us. And again, it comes back to that, the love story, and how those barriers, those barricades can crumble when we feel seen in the story.
Yes, I love that. I love that we got to that place, Kate, because that's exactly, I mean, sometimes it's hard to talk about a book without giving away spoilers, and I don't want to, but I definitely felt that often, that barricades were crumbling down, and I'm not sure that I articulated that until this moment, but that's what I was feeling as I was reading it. Well, I think we need to talk more about Ferris's grandmother, Charisse. So she's been seeing.
Charisse would like that. She would like it if we talked about her.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think so, too. I hope her ankles are not so swollen today, and she's feeling content today. But Charisse has been seeing and hearing a ghost while feeling unwell. Mm-hmm. And her character, you know, beyond the intergenerational connection that she has with her granddaughter, Ferris, she just brings a lot of intrigue to the story. So what do you want listeners to know about Charisse?
Charisse is what my mother would have referred to as a piece of work. She is like a very, very strong character who, yes, she has this particular bond with Ferris, but she's also very much her own self. And she's somebody who has lived life with her whole self. And I think that so much of when I think of Charisse, I think of the two books that are by her bed, which are the Bible and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And those two books really kind of sum up who she is. And that ghost that she sees, and it is, I guess in a weird way, it's a ghost story, is, how can I say this? That ghost is there for a reason, which is the same, not only for Charisse, but for all of us, as a reminder of something. And Charisse is tuned in enough to be aware of the ghost when a lot of people wouldn't be. But that's who she is. She's tuned in. She's certain of herself. She's led this big life, and she loves with her whole heart. So
I think for kids, this is a ghost, and it is a ghost story, but it's so subtle and soothing. And I feel like anytime like you start to go, ooh, is this like, is Kate about to take us on a spookier level than I could ever imagine? And then that refrain would come in of every good story is a love story. And you'd be like, oh, okay. No, we're back. Nope. This is Kate DiCamillo's story. I've got this. Okay. I think as an adult reader, I feel as though ghosts are definitely that metaphor of your instincts and your insides and your intuition letting you know things, right? And so for me as an adult reader reading that, I knew that this was Charisse tapping into her core, knowing what she needed to know. And you know, and as, but for kid readers, I feel like some will be perceptive and feel that, and others will just take the very literal message of this ghost. And I love that magic of, it'll be so interesting to hear readers talk about how the ghost made them feel and what they thought the ghost represented in the story. I would love to hear what kids have to say about it. Well, that's me rambling now.
Not rambling. It's like, you know, I've said this to you before, but it's just always that thing of every time I have a good discussion with somebody, it helps me understand the story that ostensibly I've told a little bit better, and makes me able to discuss it better the next time around. It's just like, you know, a good discussion with a good reader helps me understand the story. You know,
I'm glad that we can hash this out together. But what else do you want us to know about Charisse's journey and that level of love that she has with Ferris? Like, what do you want us to know about that intergenerational connection?
You know, there's this, I don't know what the study was, but just this is a general understanding in raising kids, that I think that if you have one relationship like Ferris has with Charisse, somebody who loves you absolutely, sees you clearly, celebrates your triumphs, is with you in your sorrow, as Charisse is for all of Ferris, that it's enough to sustain you for your whole life if you have that early on. So that love that Charisse has for Ferris is a gift that Ferris will carry with her for the rest of her life, no matter whether Charisse is there or not. So it's intergenerational, and it's not constrained by time and place. It goes with Ferris wherever she goes. And that's not a spoiler. That's just human, you know, again, human existence. And so Charisse gifts that great love to Ferris. And then we all get to, you know, it's a couple times now, you know, because people will ask, what do you want readers to close the book and feel? I want them to feel like they're as loved as Ferris is loved. I want them to feel like they are in that house and that they can go up to Charisse's room and sit and play cards with her. I want them to feel like what it's like to have Boomer, a dog who's part woolly mammoth and part sheepdog, sleeping on your feet at night, anchoring you to the earth. I want a kid to feel that kind of love, the way that Ferris feels love. That's what I want somebody to walk away from this book with. And if you're an adult and you feel that too, that's pretty great. But that's, and Charisse is the center of all of that. You know, she's the first love.
We have to talk about Pinky now. So, which is like complete contrast.
Long enough, yeah.
All right. So, the character of Pinky, which is Ferris's sister, reminded me a lot of the joy that I felt reading Judy Blume's character Fudge in Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. It just took me back to reading feelings as a child. And so, I also want to touch quickly on her name. And I had a guess that her name was inspired by the author, Newbery-winning author, Eleanor Estes, who wrote Pinkie Pie, because the character's name is Pinky and her full name is Eleanor Rose Wilkie. And I was like, well, Eleanor Estes wrote Pinkie Pie. So like, maybe this is a connection. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, it could have been a subconscious connection, because I read Pinkie Pie and I remember those books very, very well. I remember checking them out from the library. So it could very well have originated that way in my mind, because all the best connections are subconscious connections, I think. And, you know, Ferris is basically the one that's responsible for her nickname, you know, because she says she looks all pinky like a mouse when she's born. But it is a name that I've always loved, and I could very well have loved it from the moment I read those books when I was a kid. So I would say that's a pretty good guess. Yeah.
Huh. Well, okay. Pinky is hilarious. So Pinky's embarking on this mission to become an outlaw, and she definitely adds elements of contentiousness that bring a lot of humor to the story. So we've talked a lot about the love and the happiness, but I think we need to talk about the humor that she brings. So her character really balances the more serious themes with these great moments of levity. So as a writer, how do you strike this balance? And, you know, why do you think adding some humor into storytelling when possibly some of the other emotional themes are a bit more complex? So, you know, why is it important for you to add humor into a story like this one?
Yeah, I mean, and again, I didn't do it consciously, and nor did I summon Pinky consciously. Pinky showed up and delighted me from the minute that she showed up. So if I'm the one who's sitting there telling the story of love and more love and loss, I'm also the person who loves to laugh. And so when Pinky shows up and makes me laugh, the person who's telling you this story, then, like I said, it did not make a decision to, like, you know, balance out the more serious and weighty themes by putting Pinky on the other end and having her put her cloak on and go around shouting out of my way, fools. But she served a purpose, you know, for me, too. I was grateful for her as I was writing. Because she's one of those characters where I had no idea what she's going to do next, but I know she's going to do something. And she is a beautiful counterbalance to, like you said, the more serious themes. And boy, I loved her. And boy, she wants her own book. I tell you what.
So have you started writing your own book for her?
No, but I can feel her glowering over my shoulder. Yeah.
I think she's calling for her own book for sure. She, I think it's true. Like when you just think about life in general, there are moments that are hard in it. And there are moments that are easy, and it's those easier moments that help us get through the hard parts. So I imagine as a writer that just instinctively comes, because life isn't all doom and gloom, and it isn't all like happiness and silly antics. And, you know, I bet her antics are over the top, like her, the things that she gets up to, I was not expecting. And it was very hilarious.
Nor was I expecting those things, and I can't believe that she got away with them. Kind of got away with them. Yeah,
she kind of does. Well, let's move on to Uncle Ted's unconventional decision to paint a history of the world in the Wilkie basement, and how it raises questions about the nature of creativity and expression. Because I think sometimes the more artsy, creative minds, they can sometimes get pushed to the side. Tell us about your decision to add Uncle Ted as a character and how he ties into this sort of broader themes of what's going on in the story.
Yeah, Ted is one of those people who showed up right away with this, you know, he quits his job, and because he quits his job, his wife is like, yeah, you need to leave. And so he moves back into the house that he grew up in, which is Ferris's house, to do this thing that he feels called to do, which is to paint the history of the world. And he's not really getting very far in the painting. You know, Ferris comes down to check on him, and he's got a foot. He's painted a single foot so far. And so it is that thing, like you said, of, I think for a lot of people, they think at some point they're going to write a novel or paint a great painting or write a really meaningful poem. And they think, I'll do it later. I'll do it when I'm retired. I'll do it after the kids are raised. And I think that Ted is seized with this sudden sense of, I have to do this now. And the answers for it And in the end, he answers for it in a different way than he anticipated. But it is, it's nice to have him there, not only as comedic relief, but also as a reminder of that thing of answering for your dreams, you know?
Yes. And it's like what you talked about for yourself is that you're smart enough to get out of the way of your creative, I guess, calling that's asking to be written down on the paper. It's like sometimes just getting out of the way of and just doing what's actually coming. I also feel like you were just talking to me. So I'll stop procrastinating on my next great novel.
I was, yeah.
All right. Well, this is definitely a common theme, and we've touched on this in some of our other conversations, but words and vocabulary play an important part of your writer's voice always in all of your books. But in this book in particular, in fact, in chapter 3 on page 20, you wrote, "Vocabulary is the key to the kingdom," said Mrs. Milk. "All of life hinges on knowing the right word to use at the right time." So I ask you, Kate DiCamillo, two-time Newbery medalist with a remarkable ability to connect with readers of all ages, how do you know when you're using the right word at the right time?
I don't always know it, but what I do know is, I don't know if we talked about this in our previous conversations. I love George Saunders' book on writing called A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. And he talks in there about knowing yourself, and that it's kind of like when you're writing, you have, you know, like dimmer switches on a light where you like, you tap it up, you move it down just a little bit this way, that way. And it's not that you're getting it right in some mathematical way, but rather that you're getting it right emotionally for you. This is the word that satisfies me and that I feel is right. So it's like, I just know when I've found those words, and they're the right words for me. That doesn't mean that it's the right word for everybody else. Do you know what I mean? And it's just like listening to yourself and tinkering. Is it this word? Is it that word? It's this word. And it lands with a beautiful kind of like, and then you've got the light dimmer exactly where you want it to be. And it casts the light over the rest of the story if you can find the right word.
Do you have any words that you absolutely love or loathe using?
I love so many words, and you know, this has been something that has been, you know, I've been questioned about quite a bit, because it's just like, why are you using, and I don't consciously use a multi-syllabic word that might be on the GRE or the SAT. It's rather, I just love words. And I think if you're learning a bunch of words as a young reader, why not learn a word like incandescence or chiaroscuro, or, you know, I mean, there's just so many beautiful words. I don't have a favorite one, nor do I have any that I strongly dislike, I guess, but there are words that I have, Bianca, at the back of my notebook that are waiting to show up in a story. So there are words I have not been able to use yet, and those I'm waiting to use, words that I love that I've not been able to use yet.
I'm not going to ask you what those words are, but I mean, I really want to
tell you, because then the magic would be dissipated.
I know. That's why I'm not going to ask you, but it's really hard not to ask that question. Well, you know, I always like to end with asking the hopes, but I feel like we already spoke about what your hopes are for this story, in terms of you just always want the reader to, you know, feel less alone and to feel loved and to know that there's a person there that does love them. And I think your book does that, and you're welcome to clarify on that if you want to. But otherwise, I would love to end with you reading something to us. So it could be an excerpt from Ferris, or it could be something that, you know, that is just you're dying to read out loud.
Yeah. Wow. How about a sentence? I've got to go get my notebook. This always happens where I have to get up. A sentence that I read, it will just be a single sentence, in a book on writing that is going to come out in April. The title of the book is Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow. And it's by Steve Almond. Okay, now let me go see if I've got this written down. And because I gave the book to my neighbor across the street, who's also a writer, so I can't go and get the book, but I'm pretty sure I wrote down the quote. So hold up. Let's see.
Can I just say I love that title so much as well?
So do I.
Yeah.
I was doing an interview for Ferris, and the person who was interviewing me said, oh, I just read this book called, and I'm like, what? What is it called? And he said, I have an extra copy. I'll send you one. And it's like, I was so grateful to him because that title kind of just stopped me in my tracks. He talks about at the very end how what we're doing is, quote, convincing strangers to translate our specks of ink into stories capable of generating rescue.
I need you to read it again.
Yeah. That what we're doing as writers is convincing strangers to translate our specks of ink into stories capable of generating rescue. Isn't that a beautiful quote?
It's beautiful. And don't you just think, I feel like sometimes somebody just says something so profound and so clearly and so concise that it just blows your mind. And I feel as though every conversation that I've had with you so far, Kate, that sentence is the perfect summary for every conversation that we've had.
Yeah. And, you know, and happily, every time you and I have talked and something has stopped us in our tracks, it's not my words. It's somebody else's words, you know, and that is deeply meaningful to me to like connect with you over those words. The book comes out in April, and it is really worth getting. Truth is the arrow. Mercy is the bow. Every story is a love story.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to put the link to that in the show notes, of course, with the links to Ferris as well. So I love that you shared that. And, you know, I always like to try to finish off with my feelings about a book. And I was having a hard time deciding how to share my love for Ferris. And I kind of realized that Uncle Ted said it for me. When Uncle Ted said he needed to paint a history of the world, and I feel as though, and this might sound a bit woo-woo to listeners, but I promise you, if you read the book, you'll understand what I mean, that this story is a history of the world. And so I loved it so much. I know that it is going to make so many readers happy, as all your books do. And I just want to say that there's something magical about you, Kate, where like you're literally covered in stardust. You may not feel it when you're sitting at home in your slippers, but you somehow have cast a spell on the reading community, on educators, on humans, and it's so well deserved, and it follows you wherever you go. And I just want to say thank you for coming and sparkling on our show today, because I just appreciate it so much.
Okay, well, you've made me tear up a few times, but I want to say that this, the sprinkling of magic has come not from me, but from those people, from readers and from teachers reading aloud. And it's just like, that's where the magic is. And so I just am so grateful that I get to be a part of that in the room with it, even though, you know, I'm not there when it happens. I'm so grateful to be a part of that magic of somebody reading a book aloud to somebody else. So, yeah.
I imagine you as a star, like if a literal star. And just as you kind of move around, there's these little sparkles that just drop down. And anybody who happens to be in the right spot, that little stardust will, you know, just find their way, its way into their hearts with your stories. So.
Okay, I'm not going to cry. I'm just going to say thank you. And I'm going to say, I bet you we get to talk again soon because there's more books coming. And so I'm here I am. Whenever you want to talk, Bianca, here I am.
I'm so grateful for that. And I just want listeners to know that I joked right before we started recording today that this will be the Growing Readers podcast with your hosts, Bianca Schultz and Kate DiCamillo.
Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on this quest for growing readers. Kate invites you to visit her at katedcamillo.com. And be sure to check out our show notes to order a copy of Ferris. And remember, if you love listening to the Growing Readers podcast, you can hear it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you enjoy listening. Be sure to follow and subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform to get new episodes as soon as they launch. If you're enjoying our book chats, please leave us a review. And while you're at it, grab your phone and text a friend you know who would love to listen to this episode. The Growing Readers podcast is a production of the Children's Book Review. To find more books, just like Kate DiCamillo's Ferris, I hope you'll visit us at thechildrensbookreview.com.